Well, it's another day. It's another day has dawned. Sadly, Prince is no longer with us. But to make up for that, we've got podcast series 4, episode 8 of Linux Voice. Hello, everybody. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And this episode, we've got all the stuff that we had last episode and more, because now we've got Mike back with us.
Hooray!
We're going to have news, we're going to have a halfway reminder, there'll be finds of the fortnight, there'll be some neurons to vocalise, and we've got the voice of the masses. There's the full complement of all four of us today. Mike is back, Mike's got beer, I've got a cup of tea, Graham's got something or other.
A pint of water.
And Ben is drinking some booze that he made himself.
Respect.
So, under European laws, we're not allowed to call it beer or cider. It's a cider-like substance.
Are we still in Europe?
We are now, but stay tuned. Watch this space. Keep the 24 hours to save the pound.
If you like the sound of this, but you prefer it in a paper-based format, we do a magazine called Linux Voice, and you can subscribe to that magazine at shop.linuxvoice.com. It's not only in paper, though. We do electronic versions that are DRM-free, so you can read us wherever you are on whatever device you choose. There should be another salesy message, but I'll just shoehorn that in unobtrusively somewhere a bit later down the line so we can crack straight on with the news. News!
News. If you play the news backwards, it says, "Buy Linux Voice." It just subtly implants it into your subconscious.
I thought you were going to say, "Stay in Europe," then. Or leave Europe. Make Europe great again.
Maybe all three.
Kiss the pound.
Yeah, just push out wildly contradictory messages into people's subconscious. Right, news. First up on the news, the big news that in tech, even if it doesn't have that much to do with Linux, really, is that Bitcoin founder Satoshi Nakamoto has apparently, and I say apparently in inverted commas, outed himself. So Bitcoin, the cryptocurrency, was developed about 5 years or so ago by some shadowy figure calling himself Satoshi Nakamoto. And who this is has been completely hidden for the past. I mean, various people have claimed, oh, it's this guy, or it's that guy, and no one knows. And then this week, Craig Wright, was like, oh, it's me, I'm Satoshi Nakamoto. And this is obviously quite a big news story. You got the BBC and The Economist and various big people to put this on their front page saying this chap's the Satoshi Nakamoto. And he put up a blog post demonstrating why he was Satoshi Nakamoto. And the problem with this is we know very little about Satoshi Nakamoto. Effectively, all we really know about him is a few public keys that are from early on in the Bitcoin sequence, so from the first few blocks in the blockchain. We're pretty confident Satoshi Nakamoto signed those. So the public keys they were signed with, we know belong to Satoshi Nakamoto. That's more or less the only thing we know about him, other than he knows a bit about cryptography. So this chap was like, I'm Satoshi. So he had to prove it, because otherwise it's just some mad person claiming to be Satoshi. So he put up this big blog post showing how he could sign a message using the private keys to the public keys that we know that are Satoshi, and it all seemed hunky-dory. You gave it a quick read, think, oh yeah, he's got the private keys. Turned out the blog post was complete and utterly hokum. He hadn't signed a message. All he'd done is copy the signature from an earlier message from Satoshi and put it below a big message that was his, and sort of implied that that was a signature when it wasn't at all. It was just completely made up.
But this guy is a security expert, isn't he?
Well, this kind of depends on who you believe. He does work in computer security, but he's also got a long history of just making stuff up.
Right.
He claims to have a doctorate when he doesn't. He claimed to be have a computer in the top 500 supercomputers, which is self-reported.
Right.
And the people he claimed to bought it off claimed that they hadn't sold him anything. So he says a lot of things about himself that aren't necessarily true.
Isn't another issue with this as well that if he is Satoshi, or if that guy turns up, Satoshi, whoever he is, has something like $500 million worth of bitcoins. Is this true? So then if he turns up and suddenly says, oh, right, I'm cashing it in now, that will crash the... I don't know anything about economics. I just bought some DashPay a while back as an alternative. But could that crash the market? Could it cause massive problems?
Well, I'll get onto that in a little bit. I just want to finish the story about whether or not he is actually Satoshi Nakamoto. So he put up this blog post, which is utter nonsense, to be honest. It's got code... He puts up some scripts that he claimed prove it. First of all, the script is written in Notepad. It's a Bash script. And he's put up, not the actual script, he's put up a screenshot of him writing it in Notepad and claiming, this is my Bash scripting. I'm a super elite cryptographer. Secondly, that script doesn't even do what he says it should because there's mismatching variable names, which would allow you to make it think it did one thing and when it actually did something else. So when it appears to be using one variable that's declared in it, it would actually be using an environmental variable. And then the actual script that shows it running doesn't do what you think it does because it's using a single ampersand rather than a double ampersand. So it's running two commands concurrently rather than using it as an if in Bash. So it's just all, it's all nonsense. So it's a sort of rambling that you just casually dismiss. Oh, this guy's nonsense, whatever. But several... key members of the Bitcoin community have come out and supported him and said, actually, it really is the white chap. Sorry, I just threw a spanner there. There's literally a spanner in the works.
Why do you have a spanner in preparation for the podcast?
A better question, Mike, is why don't you?
Good answer.
So particularly Gavin Andresen, who's a chief scientist at the Bitcoin Foundation, has said, we did some stuff in a hotel room that I'm not allowed to tell you about, but it involved a new laptop and it was definitely legit and I'm completely convinced it is Satoshi Nakamoto. That was his line. It was beyond reasonable doubt. And then a little while later he said, well, I may have been duped, but I'm still fairly convinced. So at the moment, it's sort of all up in the air. This guy claims to be, but he's shown absolutely no proof. But perhaps he showed some proof to this chap who knows the stuff about Bitcoin.
But he was first outed by, was it like Wired magazine and some other publication back in December, wasn't it? So, I assume that was completely involuntarily. It was like they'd done research and tracked it back to him.
Well, this is the sort of thing you can say how voluntary it is, because he hadn't gone out and said, I am, but there is some suggestion that he may have planted evidence to deliberately lead them to him.
Right.
So there's that. And the only thing that's sort of standing in for this story now is apparently in the next few days, he's going to move some bitcoins that belong to Satoshi, that we know belong to Satoshi. But this, I mean, it's a 5-minute job to do.
Yeah.
Moving bitcoins is not hard. If he is Satoshi, he would have done it by now. He could have just gone, okay, here, give me 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Blah, 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 blah. He could have done it from his phone, could have done it from his computer, whatever he wants. Bang, proof. So I'm pretty convinced it's nonsense, but we'll wait and see if he can actually move the bitcoins.
The most important question has got to be why? Why now? Why has he chosen now to reveal his identity after all these years?
Well, that depends a lot on who you want to believe. Some people are saying that this is part of a massive scam. What you call the advance pay scam. So he's under investigation from the Australian tax authorities at the moment. And in Australia, the way the tax system works is you don't pay tax on anything until the benefits are realised. So you don't have to pay tax on bitcoins you've mined until you convert them into dollars. So he could now say, look, I'm Satoshi, I've got this 500 million in bitcoins, I really want to get this out, but I can't do it until I can pay tax on it. If you could possibly lend me the 10 million pounds in tax, I could withdraw it all. And of course, I'm Satoshi, I can pay you that back. You know I've got 500 million. So there's one school of thought that this is just setting up a massive, they're called 419 scams. Or a prepay scan, you know, from the classic Nigerian prince email trick.
Yeah.
So there's an allegation that it could be that. Because, yeah, as you said, Mikey, whoever is the real Satoshi does have about $500 million in bitcoins. Obviously, that $500 million varies wildly from day to day.
Somebody else suggested that this is maybe getting a bit sort of paranoid, but this is some big government conspiracy to destabilize Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies by making, by putting all this uncertainty and ambiguity around somebody who may have $500 million in bitcoins. I don't know how likely that is.
Yeah, I mean, this is the classic De Beers situation, that the something has value because it's scarce. So if you flood the market with bitcoins, then yeah, they would drop in value. Whether or not that would have a significant impact on the Bitcoin market as a whole, it's hard to say, because Bitcoin has survived some pretty massive crashes in the past. And would this be any bigger? Maybe, maybe not. I don't think it would have a long-term impact on Bitcoin, but it would certainly have a massive short-term impact if he did try and sell them.
What do you think?
Me?
Yeah.
I think it's nonsense. I think he's just some guy trying to get publicity. I don't think he's trying to scam anything specifically. I think he's...
He wants the glory.
He wants the glory. He's clearly, for whatever reason, he's lied about some pretty significant stuff in the past.
Yeah.
I think this is just the latest in a long line of things. And I think we should just move on.
I mean, from a complete outsider's perspective, this person that created Bitcoin is incredibly clever and has covered their tracks very effectively. And this doesn't seem to be the kind of behavior I'd expect from somebody with those kind of skills.
Yeah, and there's more to it than that. There's a lot of really clever stuff in Bitcoin that's come from Satoshi. And it's also things like, he's quite an eloquent writer. He explains it really well in the first, really back in the beginning, there's academic papers published on it and this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it's clear writing that gets to the point. His, Craig Wright's blog post, this chap, it's just rambling and incoherent. It's nothing like the writing that came from Satoshi in the past.
Right.
I mean, there is another school of thought that Satoshi isn't a single person, but a name given to used by a group of people. And that's perhaps the strongest argument for Craig Wright, isn't that he is Satoshi, but part of a group that collectively is. But I still don't think that's got legs. Like the rest of the Bitcoin community, I'm just waiting for any actual cryptographic proof, and until that exists, I'm assuming he's not.
Yeah, because it would be very easy to do. Any one of us could probably do it in 10 or 15 seconds.
Yeah. I mean, you look at this blog post, he's written scripts, it's massive. I mean, it literally took... You could do it in a single Bitcoin transaction, it takes 10 seconds to do, and you need to wait for it to verify, but that's nothing. It's trivial to prove you are, completely trivial. So I think we've beaten that story to death now. Let's move on from one prominent figure to another. This is about RMS, Richard Stallman. He's won the 2015 ACM Software System Award for GCC Development and Leadership. So this is a bit of a misnomer, because it is presented in 2016, but it's called the 2015 Award, presumably because it's looking back at the work over 2015. So
he's got this award for GCC.
Sorry, there's two people speaking there.
No, just saying that the ACM stands for the Association for Computing Machinery. That is all.
Yes.
What you were going to say was probably much better than that.
Not really, no. It was just a question. What was the name of the award again? Was it to do with his GCC contributions?
Yeah, it was the ACM Software System Award for Development and Leadership of GCC, which has enabled extensive software and hardware innovation and has been a linchpin of the free software movement. And that's a direct quote from the ACM as to why they gave it to him.
I mean, fair enough. It just seems a bit strange now because I don't think he's had anything to do with GCC for probably a couple of decades. Obviously, it was an absolute cornerstone of the GNU project when he started it. A lot of people say, well, compilers are even more complicated than kernels. So by working on GCC at the start, he enabled the whole GNU project.
Well, you don't get the kernel without the compiler.
Nah, not unless you wrote it in an assembly language, yeah. Like some nutcases. Yeah. I mean, he still deserves this. Some people say, oh, well, Stallman's just a nutter and a crackpot and stuff. But he just so often turns out to be right about things. And I think he's actually, he's getting more sort of audience aware with time as well. I saw a great presentation of him on YouTube from a talk he gave a 6 months or so ago. And he really clearly outlined the importance of free software. And he didn't, you know, just rant on about GNU / Linux for ages. It was all down to earth about, you know, why this matters, seeing the recipe of the things you use. He presented it really well.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably fair to say he is, these days, he's a speaker. That's what his primary role is. He's no longer really a coder. I'm sure he still does do bits and pieces. And he is still involved in GCC, still leads the project. And
well, there was a bit of controversy a while back, wasn't there, that he's against making GCC more modular because that would allow parts of it to be implemented into proprietary tool chains or proprietary IDEs. And then a bunch of other people have come out and said, well, LLVM and Clang is more modular, so it can interact better with different IDEs and makes it therefore a better development tool set. So yeah, that's another situation that remains to be resolved.
Yeah, I mean, he was very firm in the camp that nothing from GCC should be able to be used in proprietary software. Which, I mean, that's obviously his ideological standpoint and has been for a long time. And it is, I think it's quite interesting what's going on at the moment between GCC and LVM. And they're coming at it from quite different standpoints, really, and seeing how the compiler landscape changes. Because for a long time, there hasn't really been any alternative to GCC, at least not in the open source world. There's various other C compilers and things, but nothing with even like the reach of GCC.
So. Yeah, I don't know if LLVM Clang can compile the Linux kernel yet, but you know the FreeBSD guys are using it to pretty much, I think, to compile their entire base system. So it must be a pretty good, reliable compiler if it can build an entire robust Unix operating system.
Well, the issue was never with the quality of the compiler. It was to do with, in many ways, the vagrancies of the C language, and that there's so much unspecified behavior, and you often rely on, I don't want to say bugs in compilers, let's say quirks of compilers to get stuff to work correctly. And so much, because GCC was just ubiquitous, you wrote C for GCC, regardless of what the language specification said. If it worked in GCC, it was correct. And LVM does some things a little differently, but
Yeah, there are lots of GNU C extensions, as I understand it, that must be a bit of a hindrance for some teams. But anyway, respect to RMS for getting more credit. I mean, he's had plenty of credit over the years, but yeah.
Okay, and moving on to the third item this fortnight, the Prior is available for pre-order. And the Prior is the successor to the Open Pandora. It's a small portable Linux computer, a complete Linux computer. So it's got a battery, it's got a little screen, it's got a 5-inch 720p touchscreen. It's a resistive touchscreen. It's got a 1.5 gigahertz dual core A15 ARM processor. It's got a physical keyboard, so it's not one of these touch what-sits like so many are. And it's it's available for pre-order now for the bargain price of €500 plus VAT. For the 2 gigabyte version. That's the kicker. It's a fantastic device. I really like the idea of it. It's open, it's hackable, it's modular. So if you in 2 years, 4 years, however many years time you want to replace the motherboard, you can. There's the communications board is separate as well. So the battery's removable, you can do all these wonderful things. But it's €500.
Yeah, it would be expensive at half the price.
Mike, I played on one of the Open Pandoras a couple of years ago at Fosdem. And they're very small. So this device is it's pocket size. It'll fit in your pocket. So that makes use a keyboard too small to comfortably type on. It's not like a smallish Bluetooth keyboard with a tablet or something like that. It is a very small keyboard. And they're primarily designed for gaming, but it is just Debian that it runs, so you can use it for just about anything.
Yeah, I've heard that they're very popular amongst emulation fans. Well, I'm a big emulation fan as well, but just like Graham said before, €250, even if it was half the price, it would still be so expensive. I like the idea of this little pocket full featured computer. When I were a lad growing up north, we had Scion Series 3 computers that were also tiny little dinky keyboards, but you could write little programs on them. They had their own Dialector Basic installed, and great fun to play around on when your parents were hogging the TV so you couldn't plug the Spectrum in. But yeah, for €500, I mean, if it's got similar specs to, I don't know, a Raspberry Pi 3, and then put on a little clicky keyboard and a screen that I imagine is hardly an amazing Retina display, how does the price get up to that?
It's the small units, basically. The less you make, the more you have to pay. And yeah. it does get up to high prices, as you can see. So €500, what's that, Mike, in Queens? Is that £400?
I don't know. We're not even going to be... You guys are not going to be part of the EU soon, so I don't know. I just pay no attention.
So it's an expensive device, but the reason for that is it's small volumes, it's hackable, it's designed for tinkerers, which is great. And you wouldn't, you could say, oh, you can get Raspberry Pi with a touchscreen and a keyboard. You can get all the bits for a lot less than this, but you won't be able to fit them together into that size for less with it. One of the parts of it that did look interesting to me is the €500 version doesn't, but they've got an upgrade one, which I think they call the mobile version, which includes 4G mobile capabilities. And then you're sort of thinking, you could use that as a phone. You're going to need to do it. Doesn't come with phone software, but you could write that relatively easily, I think.
But you're better off with a phone.
But it's a phone with a proper keyboard, yeah, with a little flippy out thing. It's got a nice replaceable battery.
You could get a super cheap Chinese open Android phone, get a small Bluetooth keyboard, and it'll probably be more powerful. It'd certainly have a capacitive display.
Yeah, but if you can run your own phone software, if you're sitting in the pub and say, hey, girls, I write my own phone software, I mean, I'm sure that looks impressive.
But you could still do that with Android.
But it's not that you could use it as a phone. It's that you then got a complete Linux PC in your pocket that you can also use as a phone. Because I very rarely use my phone as a phone. That's a relatively small use case for it, to be honest.
Yeah, I know. I know that you're probably being devil's advocate because the price is just the price.
It is the price, that is. It's expensive.
Yeah.
But there isn't another device like it if you want an open hackable portable Linux computer. That's the price of making one. I generally don't think it's overpriced. It just costs a lot to do this in small volumes, and it's a small volume device.
And what's it called again? I've already forgotten in the 10 minutes we've been talking.
The Prya.
The Prya.
Prya.
I liked the Pandora name. Why did they have to change it?
Don't know.
Also, the Pandora was a lot cheaper than this. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was like €300, maybe.
Maybe it was £300.
Yeah. I don't know. Without Googling, I mean, we did have one and played with them for a while, and they were good. Obviously, they've replaced the control pad with a keyboard, but... Yeah. I hope it's successful. I hope there are enough wealthy Linux enthusiasts to make it survive.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly a lot of people in Silicon Valley and such places who enjoy open source software and on a salary where that's not such a big investment. So we shall see. Right, our final item of news this fortnight is Dev 1 reaches beta. So this is Dev 1 is the fork of Debian without systemd. And this is, so Dev 1 version 1 beta is based on Jesse, Debian Jesse. So you can install it and use it as you would Jesse, but without systemd. This is most notable, I think, because they actually got this far. Quite a few people was expecting them to never actually put out a release.
Well, that was us, wasn't it? I remember us being pretty cynical about it, about them getting organised enough. You know, we were like talking about how the logistics of dealing with the repositories and the package management and the security and all the things that they'd have to go through. So, yeah. Congratulations.
Yeah.
They still got a silly name. They seem to have made their website less silly and actually look slightly more professional. I just think that, you know, choice and everything, great. Who am I to say? But I think they're fighting a bit of a long gone war now, you know. I know not. There are plenty of issues with systemd, and there are parts of it a lot of people don't like, but just pretty much every distro has said, okay, this is, for all its warts, this is still better than the basically 1970s follow-up we had before. Kudos to them. Everybody should try these different directions. And they have gone further than many of us expected. I don't really know what to think about the release yet. I made the mistake of going to /dot to read about it. And like all the +5 comments were literally like, right, so this is something to do with the New World Order is paying Leonard Puttering to destroy Linux from the inside. Seriously, this /dot is appalling. It's the worst sort of weird hive mind echo chamber I've seen. There's probably better discussion on Reddit, I don't know.
I doubt it.
Yeah, I'm genuinely interested as to how it progresses. And I guess this will really be the testament to whether or not there is a significant number of people who dislike systemd and are willing to put some effort into avoiding it. And if there are, then it will continue and it will grow. If there aren't, it's software democracy in action.
Yeah, that's what it's all about.
Choice
for cereals.
And that's the news this fortnight.
Excellent news. Thank you, Ben. It's now time for Finds of the Fortnight. I haven't asked the IRC channel to keep us all on our toes. So is there anyone that'd like to go first?
I've got a quick one, which is related to the last one, Devwin. So
go for it.
From the Devwin website, we get spread the word. A simple way to spell Devwin is dev-1.org. Both dev-1.org and dev-1, as in numeral 1.org, point here. Oh. So that's a simple way to spell Devwin.
Good heavens. I mean,
okay. At least it's easy to spell. Systemd is easy to spell.
Yep.
There we go. That's my okay. Linux discovery. My other stupid discovery is that if you're going to move house and you don't pack, it takes you a long time, leading to knock on fatigue lasting, you know, quite a while. There we go.
There you hear it, kids.
Yeah. You'd think that my mum and dad would have known to put stuff in boxes before moving day, wouldn't you?
Yeah. How long have they lived there?
20-odd years.
20 years? I just can't imagine the state of the attic after 20 years of living in somewhere.
Yeah, just so much stuff.
Amazing.
Yeah. It was literally, I was amazed. At 1 o'clock in the morning when we were still doing it, I was amazed.
Oh.
I've moved about once a year for the past few years, and it's amazing how much it changes every time. The first time I got the train, I had my rucksack on and had a hold all in my hand, and that was my stuff. And the next time it was a car load. We filled up a car. And that was when I moved in with my fiance. The time after that, we did it in a single trip, but we rented a van. And the last time, oh, it was a nightmare. It was vans and took forever. And I'm just afraid. I'm not sure I'll ever be able to move again now. It seems to be sort of exponentially increasing the amount of stuff I have.
I know. I feel the same way. Okay. I've got a few finds. This one I didn't know. Maybe this is something lots of people will know. But I think this came up on Hacker News or Reddit recently, and it's an old thing anyway. But the challenge was it was an interview question for someone where the chmod command had its permissions changed to make it non-executable. So the question was how do you fix that situation? Because obviously you'd use the chmod command to change its permissions, and the answer is that all of those kind of commands are linked from ld-linux.so, and you can execute them directly from within the binary, the library binary. They're all within there, and you can actually do that by using the path to ld-linux.so. So I don't know, /lib or lib64, and then linux ld-linux.so, and then the name of the command, chmod. And then you could +x the chmod command in your user bin directory or wherever it happens to be. And you can do that with any of the commands that are linked inside the binary.
Which I think, can't you set permissions really easily from C? Isn't there a C library for it?
Maybe that's what you think. Maybe that's like it. Maybe you maybe you import the... or maybe if C's linked against it, you can easily get to those functions like standard IO or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's really, I thought, I can see a use case for that.
I remember once we were tidying up a server that had been, it had some malware on it, but it was appallingly ineffectual malware that had attempted to replace loads of the stuff in /bin with backdoored copies, but all the backdoored copies were compiled against the wrong architecture. So I can't remember exactly what commands we had, but I don't think we didn't have ls, so the only way you could find out what was in there is you had to hit tab. There might have been another option as well, and there were some other things
echo
missing.
Asterisk will often work for that. Echo asterisk,
will it? That makes sense. And there's some others. There's a similar situation.
I remember fixing that situation myself on the same server by installing Ubuntu 8.04 in a virtual machine and copying the binaries across, SCP them over to the folder that I was in, and then just running them like that.
That sounds secure.
Yeah. I wonder if it's in the same state. I've got another find, and that's that I've been doing a lot of remote desktop stuff recently, and VNC just doesn't hack it. It's just so labored. And do you remember, like, a few years ago there was something called NX? It's like machine remote desktop.
Yeah, we were using NX in Tanzania.
It's really, yeah, I think you might have mentioned it last podcast.
Yeah, we were running it over 3G connections, mobile connections. And it's reasonably effective. You can get a workable connection off really quite a small amount of bandwidth.
I've never understood, because fundamentally the protocol and everything behind it was open source, and they were, at the time anyway, open source clients. I never really understood why it didn't take off. But anyway, in looking for something that was better than VNC and that wasn't proprietary like the official No Machine NX clients, I came across X, the letter X, the number 2, and Go, which is an open source implementation of the NX protocol. It seems to be written in Perl or something like that. It's got a very simple GUI, but configuration is different to No Machine, but the output, the end result, is that even on a low bandwidth, you get a really responsive and excellent remote desktop environment going. It works really well. There's no need to install the NX client if you don't want to, and I'm glad that it's still alive and that people are putting effort into developing an open source client. And then finally, one final one is a website called ourincrediblejourney.tumblr.com. And this is a website that documents the communication from startup founders when their startups have been acquired. It's the Our Incredible Journey is, I think, sarcasm, because everything up there is like, every letter, email is like, they all start with, we have some incredible news to share. We've been doing this stuff. We've gone into partnership with X or whoever it happens to be. The one up there is a perfect example, actually. It's Sweep is joining a firm. And then on the third paragraph down, in amongst all this positivity, is starting May 25, the current Sweep app will no longer be accessible and all of your account data will be permanently deleted.
I think it's the one from Nest who said, incredible journey. We've now been bought by Google. Yeah. BT Dubs. None of your hardware works anymore. Yeah. Lol. Yeah.
Exactly. There's one from a
but
week
it's been an incredible journey.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. Today I am thrilled to share the news that Salesforce has acquired MetaMind. We couldn't be more excited to join Salesforce. Where's the bad bit? For unpaid web users, MetaMind's products will be discontinued on the May the 4th. For our monthly recurring users, MetaMind's products will be discontinued on June the 4th. Oh, there are lots and lots more examples anyway. If you want to learn yourself some startup culture. They're my finds.
Oh, dear. Can I go?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Cool. I have a find. It's that the Crucible Theatre in Sheffield is really, really tiny. And I know that because I went to see the World Snooker Championships 2 weekends ago.
Excellent.
That was really awesome after, you know, pretty much spending my whole life watching snooker, really. I think I've done something else. I was quite good at Mario Kart, but to actually finally go there. I only got to watch some rather boring matches, but I could sort of see parts of Ronnie O'Sullivan, which was quite cool. The good parts.
Which parts?
Yeah, sort of bits of his legs here and there. The end of his queue, yeah. I'm really glad to have gone there and seen it because World Snooker Championship could end up moving to China at some point. It's enormously popular out there. And then Linux-related, I came across two packages. The first one is called Fake Time, and it reports a fake system time to any programs that you run, and it can take natural language days. So you can say fake time in quotes 10 days ago followed by a command, and it will run the command as if it were 10 days ago. I can't actually think of any practical uses for this, so listeners, if you can, please leave something in the comments.
I can think of a practical use for it.
Go on then.
You know all those time limited trial software you have?
Very true. If only it existed on Windows.
Or if you're running Animal Crossing in an emulator and you've missed your birthday.
You sound like you speak from experience there, Graham.
What happens on your birthday?
Well, you get a present in your postbox.
Well, in the new Leaf version, which I've played, the animals actually run up to you outside your house and then take you somewhere for your birthday. So, yeah.
Your actual birthday, or like the anniversary of when you first used it?
No, your actual birthday, because there's a clock inside the DS and you have to give your birthday information, which I'm sure is not sold all over the internet. Nintendo's not like that. Nintendo's awesome. My other find is another package or program called A-Tool, which is an archiving tool. It's quite cool in two ways. It lets you expand different types of archives like zips and tarballs and rars with a single command, but it also avoids tarbombs. Now, you guys may know what tarbombs are, but that's when you extract an archive and extracts loads of files in your current directory, because whoever made the archive is a nutcase. If you extract something on your desktop, you can end up with your entire desktop full of files, or files overwriting other files. So A-Tool is clever, and if something's trying to extract a huge amount of files in your current directory, it says, no way, Jose, I'm making a new directory for it. So there we go.
Excellent.
How cool is that?
Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome.
Does that leave me?
Yep.
Right, my finds this fortnight. Actually, Mike, I was watching a film last night and I thought of you. Have you seen The Rack Pack? It's a BBC straight to iPlayer film about snooker, about the rivalry between Hurricane Higgins and Steve Davis.
Oh, I've heard about it and I've always wanted to see it, but I haven't because I'm useless. But yeah, go on.
It's on, yeah, it's on iPlayer now. Stream it via your Raspberry Pi. Or some other legal method. to be honest, I think you've got to enjoy snooker to enjoy the film. But
what did you make of it? Do you like snooker?
I used to watch quite a bit of snooker. I don't so much anymore. I enjoyed the film, but it was all right. But I think it gets more into sort of personalities of snooker in the late 70s and early 80s.
Well, certainly with Alex Higgins, there was plenty to talk about, wasn't there, with him like headbutting referees and things.
Yeah, and it's sort of about the point where snooker stopped being a game for basically drunk people and became a professional sport, mm-hmm. at least in inverted commas. right, onto Linux-related finds. My Linux-related finds, I actually, like Andrew, I also found on the DevOne website. I was sort of just looking through their install and upgrade options. And on their apt-get the sources, they had a Tor option. And I discovered there's a pluggable transport for Tor in apt. So if you want to keep your stuff secure, you can download over Tor. And I looked into this a little bit more and then got back to this sort of discussion about why it came about in the first place. And one of the arguments was there's several Debian repositories on different servers, and one of them is security.debian.org, I assume. And so someone can watch your request coming out of your server, and if they see it going to security.debian, if they don't see a request going to security.debian.org, they can know that you haven't patched a recent vulnerability. But if you put everything through Tor, they can't tell the difference between security upgrades and anything else. So you can't see whether or not someone's patched the vulnerability. And there's other reasons you may want to do it as well. But I found that quite interesting.
Is there not a risk with stuff like this that people will be like, oh, well, I want to be secure. I'm going to set up all my systems to upgrade everything. And they end up downloading LibreOffice that releases every few weeks off Tor, and that just clogs up the network. Like people watching cat videos on YouTube over Tor, is it really necessary?
I mean, to be honest, you probably, if you're using Debian, you're probably not getting that much data that you're going to... in the short term, you might download a few hundred meg here and a few hundred meg there, but it's not like people torrenting 24/7.
Yeah.
You're downloading a bit here and a bit there. So it's unlikely to have a massive difference. And part of the security of Tor is based on the number of people using it. There's a big sort of thing that if only a certain type of person uses a particular anonymity tool, that anonymity tool becomes pointless because you know that by the fact they're using it, they're that type of person. Any anonymity tool needs a broad base of use for it to actually provide any anonymity.
Yeah, yes, but there is still a limit to the exit node traffic, isn't there?
There is, but that's workable, to be honest. It's never going to be lightning fast, but it's acceptable. And you're going to take a hit on your install times as well if you use this. So there is a cost to it. So
that's true.
We're going to get into a situation where everyone just suddenly sticks Tor on all their upgrades. What else have I discovered? This isn't Linux related at all. But anyway, I was watering my garden the other day. It's that time of year. And I was like, man, this is pretty repetitive. If this was a computer, I'd just write a script, a little quantab thing, water garden. And then I was like, actually, why don't I just do that? So last weekend, I buried a load of hose pipes in the garden and did that. And it now waters itself. And
is it Raspberry Pi powered?
It's at the moment it's not. It's based on this is step one. This is like version one, or perhaps version 0.1 of the sort of the release cycle. And this is just on a straight timer using a sort of commercially available water timer. The second thing I'm going to do is moisture meters in the water, which is going to push data back, and so I can sort of make sure I'm getting the right amount of water in the right containers. Step three is to link that all together and provide a little bit of intelligence so it can see not just whether or not they need water, whether or not there's moisture in them, but whether or not there's rain forecast in the next sort of day or so, and sort of combine it all together. But I'm not there yet at the moment. It's just pushing out water. I think every 8 hours it waters them for 3 minutes.
That's very cool.
So yeah, I'm that scripting my garden.
That is. I remember Bill Gates' house of the future that he built, I think, in the 90s, and it cost him something like $20 million. And you're basically doing that, Ben, with a few bits and bobs here, living the dream.
Yeah. I'm sure Bill Gates' house had a little bit more than just watering the plants. But it saves me a job every day, so I'm happy. And I think my final find of this is... Yeah, throughout this podcast, I've been drinking some homebrew, some 6-month-old cider I bottled last November, and it's quite nice actually. It's mellowed nicely. It hasn't. I was really hoping to get more of a cider flavour because you can get that over a longer. Yeah, there's a second fermentation that can go on. You give it the real that turns your face inside out, but it hasn't got that. But it has got a very mellow, apple-y flavour, and I'm quite impressed with it. And on that note, I'm going to open my second bottle.
Excellent.
It's flat cider, in case you were waiting for a fizz.
Oh, that bit sounds good anyway.
That does sound good.
But yeah, actually, someone asked me for the recipe for this cider after we mentioned it in an earlier podcast. And I meant to give it then, and I forgot. The recipe is really simple, actually. This is... it's just supermarket apple juice. It's four parts... just apple juice that comes in like cartons, you know, Tesco value apple juice type thing, and one part cloudy apple juice with a teaspoon. So that's in a, that'll fill up a demijohn, so that's about a gallon. Teaspoon of tannin powder, so grape tannin powder per gallon, and yeah, a bit of cider, yeast, leave for a few weeks, and you've got yourself some cider.
Under what license have you just released that recipe, then?
Free as Insider.
That's under the Free as Insider license.
You should use the Beerware license. I think some BSD guys use that. If you use their software, you have to post them a beer.
Well, yeah, you've got to send me a cider. Although I'm not sure I'm the originator of this. This is just pour a load of Apple products into a demijohn and... wait for it to brew. Yeah.
Right.
Those are my finds.
Excellent. Thanks. Thanks everyone for the finds. That was a really good find section.
So according to my clock, we are 52 minutes in, which must mean it's time for the halfway reminder. Still to come. We've got neurons to vocalise and we have the voice of the masses.
Is it me now, or do you want to deliver another commercial message?
No, it's you. I don't want to get too over-commercialised. But, I mean, you can subscribe to Linux Voice at shop.linuxvoice.com.
That's the one, yeah. So, after weeks of not having any neurons, like buses, two come along at once. Rich Wareham says... I was listening to the latest podcast where Graham, I think, grumbles about Ordnance Survey data not being free for commercial use. While that may have been true in the past, I really recommend looking at the set of open data products now available. And he's got a link there. He says they're all available under the Open Government License, which explicitly allows you to exploit the information commercially and non-commercially, for example, by combining it with other information or including it in your own product or application. Then Rich says, I'm using the OS data on the road network at work combined with a Highway England's real-time traffic feed to build up a database of traffic flow. Now it's a nice example of cross-government Quango data reuse. And he also talks about using some of the data with Minecraft and the British Museum to make a Minecraft version of the British Museum, which is sounds rather cool. So sounds like, according to Rich, they're making good progress with that data.
Yeah, that's, and thanks for bringing that up, actually, because I meant to mention it after he tweeted our account with the information about ordnance survey data being commercially, you can use it commercially. So yeah, that is really good to know.
Yeah, for all the things we grumble about in the UK, and within good reason, I think there's one thing that the government, or you know, the public bodies are making good progress in: open data, open standards, using the open document format for communication. That's really good. And then we had a neuron from Tom Greg, or Greg, I guess, not in Germany in this one, who says, one question I would like to pose to the team is this. Knowing about all the various methods of data collection by all the massive tech corporations via mobile phones, computers, websites, and browsers, how much does that influence how much you at Linux Voice use your devices? Specifically, would you use the Tor browser day-to-day instead of Firefox or Chrome? Email encryption, CyanogenMod without the Google additions. He says, I, for example, uninstalled the Facebook app from my phone when an update wanted a permission to allow access to my text messages. I thought they can flip right off. And now I have a webpage shortcut to Facebook on my phone. This question is prompted by an episode of the Nerdist podcast with Alex Winter, where he's talking about his movie Deep Web. During the podcast, it is mentioned that he has a piece of tape over his camera on his phone to prevent prying eyes. This, in my opinion, does seem a little extreme. Or is it? Well, Tom, I see exactly what you're saying. I don't have the Facebook messaging program installed on my phone for the same reason, because it demands pretty much access to everything you do. I still go through the mobile web page, and every time I tap on a private messaging conversation, it tries to send me to the Play Store to download the app, but I'm willing to put up with that annoyance. To me, it's so much a battle between convenience and privacy as well. I just don't post anything important on Facebook. And yeah, we try and use email encryption. I wouldn't use Tor day to day because, like we were saying beforehand, I don't want to blog, I don't want to lock up the or utilize so much bandwidth of the Tor network by just watching Elon Musk talk for an hour every day. But what about the rest of you guys?
I actually also don't use the Facebook app because, to be honest, looking back, I'm not completely sure if this is an issue with the Facebook app or an issue with my phone, but it turned on GPS every time I used it. And I thought, I just felt very uncomfortable with that.
It could do that itself. You didn't have to enable it.
Yeah, yeah. Every time I opened Facebook, the GPS little location icon appeared.
That's well dodgy.
Yeah, and I was like, no, you're gone. And yeah, like you say, you can't do the private messages anymore from the mobile website, which is annoying, but yeah, that rarely affects me.
Well, you can do it.
Use Facebook.
You can do it. It's just every single action that you do, it redirects you to the Play Store. So I just have to keep tapping the back button when I'm away on my phone trying to do this. It's just back button message.
You're obviously more determined than me. I gave up and assumed it was impossible.
Well, I would as well. It's just, unfortunately, there's a lot of people I know that use Facebook to communicate. So,
I actually don't consider putting tape over a camera to be an especially paranoid thing to do. I don't do it on my phone. My camera on my main computer isn't ingrained. It's a separate webcam that I attach, and I flip it away for me when I'm not using it, because it is something that is done, and not just from the security services, from various hackers and whatnot, and I just don't like it pointing at me. I don't think it should be there. When I've got no use for it, I will make sure the camera's not recording me.
I agree with you. I don't think it's paranoid to do it. It's probably unlikely that we're being spied on from at that level at the moment. But, you know, ever since the Snowden revelations, we've got to be beforehand. If somebody had said it, and you're sitting in the pub and somebody's like, well, the government's like hacking into fiber optic cables to steal all data and stuff, you'd be like, yeah, whatever, mate, you know, get your tinfoil hat on. But we know there's a lot of really dodgy stuff going on out there. So it's worth taking precautions just because it's your life. But
yeah, And as for other stuff, I'm probably wrong in this, but I very firmly feel that I shouldn't. If you get into the point where you think, oh, I have to use Tor to look at this, or I have to do that, then you've almost kind of lost in a way. We should be free people. We shouldn't have to fear being spied on.
And almost
out of principle, I don't. And so, yeah, this is my web history. You know, I'm sure GCHQ can find out all the various things I've been looking at, and a lot of them are, you know, part of my job is looking into people doing bad things with computers. As you know, I spend a lot of time on hacking, some time on hacking forums and that sort of thing. And that's there. I'm not going to be cowed into using Tor just because somebody might not like what they see in there.
I think that's a very good point. If we all think, well, we'll better use Tor on a day-to-day basis, then we're just in the same position as in China or North Korea.
And it comes into that sort of point of self-censorship. You stop yourself doing something that you feel that you should do because of how it might be perceived. And I know there is a point where that's a very healthy thing to do if you live in a repressive regime. And if these things are happening, but I feel that part of the fight back is by refusing to be cowed into using that. But
absolutely. Yeah. It's something we should all be aware of. And thanks to Tom and Rich for their neurons there. If anybody has more thoughts or ideas or questions or rants for me to read out, email me mike@linuxvoice.com.
So that must mean it's time for the voice of the masses. In which we asked, where does Thunderbird belong? Apparently because the Mozilla team wants to get rid of Thunderbird. Thunderbird is an email client, which is developed by the people at Mozilla. But Mozilla have got their hands full with Firefox, their web browser, which is adding enormous numbers of features and becoming a bloated entity that just wants to take over everything. So they don't need Thunderbird anymore. So where should Thunderbird go? Who should look after it? Does it need to survive? Where is the best place for Thunderbird now? Hugh says Wigan. Anybody else got anything more sensible to say before we get on to the masses? No? Fine. HegX64 says, I think Blue Systems should fund it. Duncan Murray says, I use Mutt. Thanks, Duncan. Now then, Toby says, I hate Thunderbird. It's overloaded with stuff. From all I hear, horribly programmed. It has fundamental flaws. The search function, for example, doesn't deserve its name. It has a UI that is impossible to describe without using the words 1990s and ugly. Nevertheless, I absolutely depend on it, and every competitor sucks much, much more. Exactly how I felt about OpenOffice.org. So I hope the Document Foundation will work similar miracles here. Going to the Document Foundation? Or is this... I mean, Mike, you said that in the... You put that forward as a candidate in the question.
It is one possibility that there's been no decision made from either side about this. From some of the one of the options is the Software Freedom Conservancy. One of the options is the Document Foundation. But in this case, it's all just discussions. The Mozilla people would have to agree to that. The Document Foundation would have to agree to that as well. Their entire structure, board of directors, membership committee, very democratically would have to agree to that. With that guy who was saying, well, look at the miracles the Document Foundation has made with LibreOffice. Well, you know, to some extent that's true, but it just, if Thunderbird went to the Document Foundation, it doesn't mean overnight that there'd be a load of new developers or money available to Thunderbird. It is a separate program. The Document Foundation is working to try and get people involved in LibreOffice, but it's a big, long job. So whether it's the best home for it or not, I don't know. On the one hand, it would be great to have an email suite as part of an email client as part of the Office suite. A lot of people say Microsoft Office is so good because Outlook is so integrated, but this would not be an overnight thing. Thunderbird wouldn't suddenly have loads of money and developers working on it if it was at the Document Foundation. It could take years, if at all.
Yeah, because one of the things that happened with LibreOffice when it joined the Document Foundation was there was a lot of latent interest in developing for it because it was so hard to get patches into Oracle's OpenOffice. There was a group of developers that wanted to do it but couldn't. So as soon as it switched over and they were like, actually, yeah, we'll accept your patches, there was that sort of groundswell ready to push stuff in quite quickly. Whereas with this, that isn't the case. At the moment, if you want to patch Thunderbird, you can. It's supported by an open organization who takes patches from the community.
Well, the Document Foundation is a quite a popular choice. James, Ray Woods, David G, Marco, perhaps sarcastically says, maybe it could be morphed into the LibreOffice suite. Yeah, and after that, the whole LibreBird office could be morphed with VLC. Then that whole thing with GCC, and then maybe it could swallow a few torrent clients as well, just for the integration hype's sake. David Nash looks at it from a different angle. He says, perhaps the question is best posed as, which organization can best withstand the problems and costs that Thunderbird brings with it? Thunderbird brings next to no revenue stream, so every other issue is hampered with perennial questions regarding how to pay to solve them. Bitrot, rendering engine, manpower. Taking on Thunderbird has the feel of a poison pill, and I have difficulty wishing it on any organization as a result. Is that fair?
I must admit, my feeling here is the best place for Thunderbird is in the bin.
Yeah, I agree with you.
It's not a good email client, it's just better than the others.
Yeah. I think the best focus for energy should be on creating something new and lighter. I mean, I got really excited about Geary, for example. Mm. Something that has a different kind of take on how email is. And the way that email has moved on, even Windows 10 version of Outlook is a big improvement over Outlook from 2007 or whatever lots of people are using.
Yeah, and I think Thunderbird, yeah, it's big, it's bloated, it's using outdated technologies, it's using XUL, it's using stuff that no one else is using. So if that's going to continue in Thunderbird, that has to be supported specifically for Thunderbird. So, and it just doesn't make sense. Email clients aren't fundamentally that hard. The challenge with making an email client isn't really the technical challenge of programming email. It's the challenge of making a good user interface. And the best way of doing that isn't to start with an existing bloated email client and stripping back. It's to build up something new. And I think that's the way forward. I think we should rally behind a different email client that's based on new technologies, that's got a good, simple interface that can be extended rather than try and chip away at an old one.
Yeah.
Yep. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
Excellent stuff. Right. So what Ben just said there, that sounds a lot like Mark C's comment, who says, the rot set in when Mozilla stopped promoting Gecko Zool as a platform in order to focus on Firefox. Having to support other types of applications kept the platform relevant, but now it's become a millstone dragging them down, a burden to maintain, but still necessary for Firefox. Words. Better, I think, to keep Thunderbird on live support while someone develops a Thunderbird killer based on another platform. The Document Foundation would be a good base, as they could use the LibreOffice framework and aim for optional integration with LibreOffice. The FOSS world needs a good email client, but Thunderbird's days are numbered simply because of the foundations it's built on.
I do think it's a great opportunity. We've talked about like the data, how outdated the email protocol is, how unsuitable it is for encryption. And it's the same with instant messaging and chat as well. I do think there's a space for a really beautiful UI that incorporates modern kind of encryption technology and messaging. And that's kind of an important role for some free software, open source advocating organization to perform.
But do you not need then a lot of the infrastructure for this as well? Isn't that the problem, that Microsoft, as well as making the software, will then, you know, have a massive army of data centers to provide this? So they say, oh, install Office and Outlook and we'll handle all your data, for better or worse. So even if the Document Foundation was to take on Thunderbird or develop its own email client, to integrate it all together, and like you say, with encryption and messaging and everything better than 1970s or 60s email. Where does that infrastructure come from?
I wouldn't say the Document Foundation is a good fit, personally. I think it's got a pretty clear mission statement, the Document Foundation, and I think it's easier for everyone if it sticks to it.
You see, my thought on this is it's the Document Foundation itself, you're right, that does have quite a clear fit, but a lot of the people working with the foundation are in quite a good position to sell an email client. For example, Collabora's Office Suite would be better if it had an email client with it.
Yeah.
That would be a better sell. So they, and you know, other people do sell LibreOffice to, a supported version of LibreOffice to organizations like they have in Linux. I'm sure they have some people supporting theirs. Those are the people, really, I think I would look to either support Thunderbird or put them, because let's be honest, it needs money. Someone needs to stump up for some developer time to create a good basis for it to be built on. And I know that, who is it who did Geary? I forget the company's name. Yorba?
I don't know.
Yeah, that rings a bell.
Yeah. They got some money for it, and they got as far as they did, and yeah, I mean, it worked well, but it's still quite basic.
Yeah.
I think it becomes quite a hard sell for people like Collabora when there's not a good email client to go in with it.
Yeah. Go on.
And whether or not that is what we consider a traditional email client, whether or not that's a webmail client, I think remains to be seen. Because so few people actually use email clients these days, don't they? Isn't everything webmail now?
I know I use them.
Yeah, but you need Arch Graham.
No, I think it's another good point that people are talking about the possibility of you combine LibreOffice with Thunderbird, and then you have this sort of equivalent to the Microsoft ecosystem. But could it not make more sense? A lot of people say LibreOffice needs an email client, or people like Collabora want to put one in there. Would it be better to make one from scratch instead of taking on a massive legacy code base from Thunderbird for the LibreOffice guys with the resources, you know, where possible, and just say, okay, no, email and collaboration is an important part of the suite. Let's make our own client from scratch using the toolkit we've got, using all these things, instead of trying to bring in an absolutely enormous other code base. Who knows?
Oh, we'll have to see. Yeah, I would absolutely start from scratch. But I can definitely see a space in that area for an email client, because of this commercial application.
Oh, yeah. There is a demand. There's a huge demand amongst users of LibreOffice for email built in. But, yeah, how do they go about it?
I think that brings us to the end. we've discussed plenty over the last hour and a half, but we've eaten nothing, which means it's time for me to go and eat something.
This is true.
So,
you're not eating,
no,
Andrew?
No, I've not eaten.
Oh. Neither have I.
Oh, dear.
Exciting.
It's 10:30 here in Bayern.
It doesn't matter where it is. What time is it in Bayern?
It's still at least 2 hours after Yorkshire pudding time in Yorkshire.
That's true. Yeah, it is. So I'm going to go and address that. I hope everybody listening has also eaten, or is about to eat soon. May your bellies be ever full. And we'll see you in 2 weeks. So, bye-bye, everybody.
Yeah. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.